Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 81, section 3, which is old single column, page 903. We just got started on this final paper, as we said last time, not only the immediate block of papers here on Adam and Eve, but also, you could say in a transcendent way, arching back over all that and finishing up the civilization papers as well. So in other words, having laid out all of the basics relative to the prince and his staff and their consequences, and Adam and Eve and their consequences, we can sort of fully bring the discussion of the human phenomenon up to kind of the full beginning of recorded history. And we have the predicates to be able to address that sort of beginning of our significant memory of ourselves from every angle. We can approach it however we need to, because the revelators have filled in all the blanks so that we have the coordinated essential knowledge, and they can then further reveal truth. As we were talking about last time, we were seeing how this final paper was giving us thumbnail sketches of the basic knowledge that they've laid out, and because they've done that, it can now be summarized and presented in a coordinated fashion, and you can then think about what one can recognize predicated on that relatively complete picture. As I was just saying, we can approach things from just about every direction now. Okay, and so recall that the preceding section 2 was the tools of civilization. So they were getting those basics laid out again, and now they're ready to take us to the next step where it gets more sophisticated with cities and commerce. And of course, the manufacture that commerce is predicated on, the industry that it's predicated on. You may recall, we touched on those various issues before, back in the civilization papers. So let's see what they lay out here for us this time, in terms of a little higher synthetic presentation of the material. Okay, go ahead.
Number 3, cities, manufacture, and commerce. The climatic destruction of the rich open grassland, hunting and grazing grounds of Turkestan, beginning about 12,000 BC, compelled the men of those regions to resort to new forms of industry and crude manufacturing. Some turned to the cultivation of domesticated flocks. Others became agriculturists or collectors of waterborne food. But the higher type of Andite intellects chose to engage in trade and manufacture. It even became the custom for entire tribes to dedicate themselves to the development of a single industry. From the valley of the Nile to the Hindu Kush, and from the Ganges to the Yellow River, the chief business of the superior tribes became the cultivation of the soil, with commerce as a sideline.
Okay, so they want to start with that climatic stimulus again that we've touched on a number of times. As I was saying, you know, beginning about 12,000 BC, the changes in the climate are forcing changes in humans. And notice that, see, here they're taking it yet one more notch. For sort of the least imaginative, they go from the obvious hunting to herding. For the little more imaginative, they might jump over herding and go directly to farming. But not just that. I mean, obviously, you have to at least do that so that you don't starve to death. You got to be getting your food some way or another. But on top of that, you know, in a sense, to jump even further than the requirements that got you out of the nutrition epic, okay? But to jump all the way to that more abstract concept of, as they're pointing out there, trade and manufacture. And you notice that, you know, no matter how, you know, in some ways obvious it might be, nonetheless, the precision is there. It doesn't say manufacture and trade. It says trade and manufacture. You know, manufacture is the foundational word because you have to manufacture before you can trade. You know, and so there. But the fact that that's so obvious, that's a way, you know, if you're still wondering, well, is it genuinely the case that the second word is the foundational word? I mean, you can see it right there. Obviously, you have to manufacture something before you can trade it. Okay.
Sometimes forgotten today.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, you know, and of course, the more digital we get, you know, the more it might seem like you don't have to manufacture something before you trade it. But even in a virtual sense, there has to be some, construction of something or other that people, you know, some individuation that people can point to or fixate on or whatever, right? I mean, it can't just be an amorphous nothing. But, you know, kind of more to, you know, I'm sure what Gene was you know, getting to, you know, it is a very foundational, important fact that you have literal material manufacture. You know, they're about to point out how foundational that is to civilization. And, as I suspect you were thinking, how in recent years people have started to imagine otherwise, that somehow you could, you know, that especially you could have the incredible future civilizations that you imagine with, you know, not being predicated on that very literal, tangible, material foundation and the interplay because of it between peoples. Okay? So there, see, we're already starting to see what we kept seeing last week. You immediately start noticing how it's, you know, since we've already covered it kind of in a historical context and are now just summarizing, it immediately gets you thinking about not what happened way back when, but how this is relevant to now. Yeah, that's that's the point of and when by sweeping through in this summary fashion, it reminds you of why the revelation is here. All these key foundational elements of civilization, the moment you start imagining, you know, usually delusionally imagining that somehow these aren't indispensable foundational elements, civilization's in jeopardy. there has to be literal, tangible manufacturer as the predicate for nations, as we'll see here in a second. Okay, the other element there is just doing that quick little getting you kind of do a figure S, through the sort of the seats of civilization, from the Nile to the Hindu Kush, you know. And so, in other words, you know, wrapping through the Fertile Crescent and over there to Afghanistan, right, and then dropping down, right, into Pakistan and India across the Ganges and wrapping all the way up through China, up to the Yellow River. All right, so that whole big S-shaped curve of sort of the seats of Andite influence that we went through in the preceding papers. All right, and then see that giving you that final statement. See, so the chief business of the superior tribes became the cultivation of the soil. So, all right, they're going to have agriculture as the main way of feeding themselves. And on that foundation, that stable foundation, they can now add this element that isn't immediately necessary for those earliest stages of civilization, the nutrition epoch and the security age. Right? You can start to think beyond that. What could we do now that we've gotten some of those issues, roughly managed? Not like there still isn't, famines and attacks by hordes and whatnot, okay, but it isn't all-consuming now, those two issues. All right, so what else do we have here?
The increase in trade and in the manufacture of raw materials into various articles of commerce was directly instrumental in producing those early and semi-peaceful communities which were so influential in speaking the culture and spreading the culture and the arts of civilization. Before the era of extensive world trade, social communities were tribal, expanded family groups. Trade brought into fellowship different sorts of human beings, thus contributing to a more speedy cross-fertilization of culture.
So they don't waste any time. Second paragraph, there it is. One of the very foundational facts that allows you to get from tribe to nation, from tribes to nations? Commerce. And we've seen that before, you remember the visionary peace planning paragraph, for instance, the importance of trade. The fact that to go from tribes to nations is to take that first very big step to doing something distinctly unnatural. See, there's their point. Expanded family groups. See, tribes are natural. The folkways of tribes are natural. The mores of nations, not as much. Right? It begins to take on the fruits of creativity more. When you go to mores from folkways, when you go from tribes to nations. Okay, so... and we're even saying extensive world trade, right? Even world trade, not just regional trade. So see, that brought into fellowship. See, and again, to use that word, right? Not just, engagement or something, right? But see, like I said, see, because it's in order for this to happen, there has to be a little bit more of your actual human, personal nature in play. So the interplay between individuals inescapably has a little bit more of a personal element to it. Even if, right, it's fundamentally driven by profit motive, right? Of course, that's one of the indispensables, and you're kind of seeing why, profit motive is an indispensable again. It's something kind of very self-focused has to, you know, has to be your initial driving force. Okay, yes. But to achieve these, what appear to be greater selfish ends, actually you're unwittingly beginning to transcend selfishness and starting to interact on higher levels of meaning. Okay, so that it's, you know, you can use a word like fellowship to describe it. The fellowship of tribes is a nation. Okay. So, it's just, again, how relevant that is today when there's all these voices that say that nations are innately bad and have to be, rejected, and we need to just, adopt globalism. As we've pointed out so many times, relators, say that is extremely confused thought. Do you think that the angels of nation life are a group of angels that, they're just outmoded now? We've gone way up past, master seraphim in our enlightenment. It's obviously so absurd. Nations are the essential elements of a world enlightened life. In the same way, why? I mean, it's so much more individuated than the unity likeness of a globe. Well, again, what have we said about this? I mean, your personality is absolutely unique. So if you totally fuzz away your individuality, where is the place for your personality to identify? Right? It can't identify in some pool. There has to be an individual for something that's absolutely unique to identify with. No overlap with others. You can't be a drop of water pooled into an ocean and expect any personality to identify with such a fact. Individuality is an indispensable part not only of your personal future, but of the world's more personalized future. It's predicated on individuality. And if you let your unity consciousness convince you otherwise and blur everything into a warm fuzz, right, you can forget about your personality and you can forget about light and life. Because it can't, there's no way for it to manifest. The whole point of existence is the separation, the differentiation, so that it can be genuine relationship. Right? If there aren't distinct individuals, there can't be relationship between two persons. If there aren't distinct nations, there can't be the super additive consequence that you need to get to light and life. You've short-circuited the potential that powers you up to light and life.
Is globalism different than global government?
Yeah, basically the ism. See, that tricky thing of
globalism meaning.
Let's
actually down in the light and life. Everybody's in the same language, same religion. Things are blended. They may all be brothers and sisters, so to speak. But mm-hmm. What you're saying is that when they there's a difference there between the differentiation of various nations, which eventually, I guess, come together more and more.
The thing is, we're not born equal. So there has to be some, institutional, gross institutional recognition of that fact. If we were all born equal, you wouldn't need nations. Right, if nothing else. I mean, there's obviously a lot of other reasons I could bring up too, but just start with that one. Because the reason I focus on that one is it's the failure to recognize that we're not born equal that is driving people to this false ism right now. Well, we're all, kindred spirits, so we ought to be able to just be one global people. We're all citizens of the globe. No, no, that you're getting way ahead of yourself. And like we're pointing out, even when there's one language, you know, one religion, all these incomprehensible things to us right now, even then, on a normal world, there's still nations. Because not only are you not born equal, so that physically and intellectually there's differentials, but there's geography. I mean, so it's not just a nature issue, there's a nurture issue. Different regions on the planet nurture people differently. And that leads to the need for limits, where you need to sort of you have a people of that place, right? A nation, right? The people of a certain place that are of that, the nurture of that place, but you should be saying to yourself already, if you've got a spiritual consciousness, okay, yes, but can't we transcend the nurture of the geography? Well, remember, as you're going towards light and life, the things and the beings are coming more and more together. They're not getting farther and farther apart. You're not less and less synchronized with the geography, with the things, the dirt of the earth. You're more and more synchronized with the dirt of the earth as you go towards light and life. See, so it's even more the case that, when this world is deeply settled in light and life, it won't have a homogeneous surface, right? There will be differential on that surface. And there's people that are synchronized with what's, here on this region of the planet, a region that is now fixed relative to eternity by master physical controllers into something, that it isn't even remotely what it is right now. But no, see, they're not going to make it, like a cue ball where every point on the globe is the exact same white spot. It's not going to be like that. Right, so again, the nations are that, the people of a place. And yeah, sure, it isn't merely nations. They're nation states, right? They're territorial states, but territorial states of one nation, not a collection of tribes. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. This may help to look at it personally. As an American, I have a place in the world. Mm-hmm. As a Eurasian, I have a place in the heavens. When I leave this world, I'll have a place in the heavens. But mm-hmm. as long as I'm of this world, I need a place.
Yeah. Right, there's just, so many things. Yeah, you got something too?
Similarly, each planet in the whole cosmos is individuated.
Right, yeah.
Each other, they're not blended together.
The universe of universals will never be homogeneous. Right? It will never be some false manifestation of your bias to your unity consciousness. It will never be that, right? Yeah, it's like, well, why not? Well, if nothing else, it's all predicated on the pattern universe. And you pretty much have to admit that the central universe is the pattern universe for the seven super universes, and every one of the billion worlds in the central universe, well, in Havona, and there's also the circus of the Father, Son, and Spirit, but the billion worlds, every one of the billion worlds of Havona is absolutely unique, right? It's not an amorphous, homogenized domain, right? The individuality there is immutable. Despite the fact that it was all created perfect and everything, that perfection didn't somehow erase individuality. It's perfectly individuated.
And so, which doesn't mean only one of the billion planets has water.
Yeah, right, of course not. Right, but, everyone has an absolutely unique pattern to it. The other thing about globalism, just to focus on the ism part a little bit more, we have to keep ourselves in the proper mode. When you're in tribes, there has to be a degree of spiritualization of material affairs that drives you, quasi-religiously, if you will, kind of gets your zeal involved a bit in going from tribe to nation. So when you're in tribes, there's an appropriateness to nationalism. Okay, but once you have nations firmly established, okay, all good things taken to extreme become bad. You need to drop the ism. Right? You're going to keep the nation, but drop the ism. Okay, and now you need to be motivated by the next higher ism. With solid nations, you're now going to be driven by the concept of internationalism. Okay? And once you have established that, and you know, a definitive, solid national interplay, then you can be driven by globalism. But, you know, the nations haven't evaporated. Obviously, it's impossible to have international relations if you don't have nations. But you got all kinds of people that are saying, we should have international, you know, things, not national things. It's like, okay, that's illogical. The root word in international is national, right? It's like trying to have trade when you don't have manufacture first. What are you going to trade? you could trade slaves, I guess, okay, or stuff. But, you know, obviously we're talking about thingies. I'm starting to make stuff. It's keeping, keeping that spiritual energization, you know, ahead. If it becomes something you're applying to the present, you know, to the idea of the present, then it becomes a false spiritualization. But if it's of ideals, if it's of the future, if it's of your destiny, right, there's some validity to it. But you have to be ready, once you get there, to let go, okay, and keep that spirit ever ahead of you, right, so that you don't end up with material idealism. And so that's the thing. I mean, but see, these things are so ignorantly talked about. I mean, people think that nations and nationalism are synonyms. And that's you know, the beginning of a big problem, and people talking about this. You know, and so as soon as someone talks about nations, they go, oh, you're a nationalist. No, just because you're talking about nations doesn't mean you're a nationalist. And besides that, if things are, you know, we've talked about how, you know, the big problem in the United States is we're losing our nationhood. We're falling back into tribes. You know, the more we definitively get into tribes, the more appropriate it is for there to be a little bit of an ism to nations. Again? Okay, because you know, if there isn't, what would motivate you? You start to falsely exalt tribes, and tribes become an end of themselves. You know, they're innately divine, and yada yada yada. So, you got to think about this in evolutionary process, and you know, at some points in the book. You know, I think people know they'll use the word nationalism, and it seems to have a definite negative tinge to it. It's like, yeah, well, look at the context. That's because they're talking about, you know, the point where you've got solid nations and you need to be looking to the next level. You're getting stuck there, right? And ismizing.
The biggest impairment to world government is national. Of course, they need to go through the whole thing.
Yeah. Right. But see, as I say, I mean, it's the ism part. It's not nations are an impediment to world government. Nationalism is an impediment when that ism has been taken beyond its point of evolutionary validity. Right. See, so there's a subtlety to this. You can't think in simplistic existential terms about it. Okay. All right, so you get it. You know, the fact that we just expanded that so much. That's one of the big things that's running through here. That huge issue that, just, you know, pause to reflect for a minute. If you think back, say, 20 years, I mean, you could listen to public discourse about politics and whatnot until you were blue in the face, and no one ever said tribalism. Now you hear it every day. Because on the one hand, people are thinking that, oh, the answer is tribes. That's what that'll lead, give us light and life if we just have tribes. And then the other people are saying, what? Don't you understand that that was, you know, the hard-fought effort over the last many centuries was to get from tribes to, you know, rudimentary nationhood? Right. You know, and so both sides are, you know, are talking about tribes and tribalism. You hear, you know, you don't just hear tribes. Initially, you heard tribes, but now you're actually hearing tribalism all the time. Right? Both being held up as a positive and saying, no, that's a negative. We're a nation. That's looking backward. Just note that. I mean, the very fact that in just a few years, tribalism is a commonly used word again is the emergency that we're reading about. Right? We'd gotten to the point where we'd never, you know, at least in the United States, we didn't use that word. That was all in the rearview mirror. Now it's the delight of the moment, or the terror of the moment for the handful of people that still have some reflective awareness. Okay. What else do they give us here?
About 12,000 years ago, the era of the independent cities was dawning. And these primitive trading and manufacturing cities were always surrounded by zones of agriculture and cattle raising. While it is true that industry was promoted by the elevation of the standards of living, you should have no misconception regarding the refinements of early urban life. The early races were not overly neat and clean, and the average primitive community rose from 1 to 2 feet every 25 years as the result of the mere accumulation of dirt and trash. Certain of these olden cities also rose above the surrounding ground very quickly because their unbaked mud huts were short-lived. And it was the custom to build new dwellings directly on top of the ruins of the old.
Okay, so anyone's familiar with archaeology, what do you call those hills or mounds? What's that word that the archaeologists, especially in the Middle East, you know, you'll hear them using that word. What's the name for that hill? It's from basically an Arabic word for hill or mound. Tell. Right? Those are called tells. You know, you look out across the desert. Why is there that little mound out there in the desert? You know, you go in there. It's an old city mound.
It's an old right? Motel.
It's now like the geologists would say. You know the big red rock down in Australia. You got this very flat land. It's called a peneplain in geology. And those little residual things that didn't get eroded flat like everything else did are called monadnocks, right? Right. You're looking out across the flat desert, and it's like the red rock, you know, down in Australia. It's a monadnock on a peneplain, right? It's just this very oddball-looking thing sitting out there on this flat desert floor, right? And, you know, everyone just ignored them for ages, and then, you know, then finally, really, wait a minute. These are archaeological gold mines. Let's, you know, you start digging down in these things.
Were the houses built on houses?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I like they're saying there at the end, a lot of the bulk of this great big hill is all the mud bricks that have piled up, you know, like they're saying, these unbaked mud huts, you know, collapsing. And,
2 to 3 feet in 25 years, a lot.
Yeah, right. I mean, you throw in, trash. You know, just a couple thousand years, and you've got a serious hill, right?
Yeah. They didn't have for trash. They didn't have plastic.
Well, yeah. See, like I was saying, I mean, just the mud piling up from the, you know, the houses that fall apart, you know, it's going to give a lot of it. But then there's just, you know, we have street sweepers. You know, let the dust build up, you know, for a few centuries and see how deep the dust gets if you don't sweep it away.
And tree leaves
and yeah, and whatnot. You know, and then just all the food scraps and you know and whatnot and
yeah, we're even,
yeah.
Just gonna chuck it.
Right? Yeah, bones and you know, human waste. Right? I mean, think of how much human waste a city, you know, produces in 2,000 years. Right? You know. You can't use a latrine that you dig forever. It fills up. Okay, so right, it's just all that piling up because there's no...
So they're trying to remind us the early urban life that people, if they're wanting to go back to tribes, it's going to be unclean and
yeah.
A mess.
Right. And just how, you know, how little you have to go back in the past to find raw sewage running down the sides of city streets. You don't have to go back very far before that was the case, right? And there was the boards, you know, that you walked across to get from the center of the street, you know, to the sidewalk or boardwalk or whatever. You know, and the ladies needed to lift up their skirts just a little bit, you know, trying not to show anything. But you didn't want your skirt to drag through the sewage, okay? So you walked across this little board. Yeah, that was very recent, okay? It took mankind a long time to be able to get to, you know, to think abstractly enough and to think, to have to see themselves as a people of the future enough that you would sweep the streets. See, these are people of, at best, the present, and probably a lot of them of the past. They're not people of the future. Never, so they aren't thinking, you know, I should sweep the streets because tomorrow then the street would be clean. You know, they don't think in a future time orientation like that.
No way to repave it if you don't let stuff pile up.
No.
That's my new pavement.
All right, so it's just...
there's people nowadays that have a mess and
yeah.
See the future.
Yeah, right, and just carry that forward, you know, many, many generations, you know. You know, and just what a pile of used cars and cinder blocks and whatnot, you know, would be piled up there. Okay.
They don't call them trailer gems.
Okay. The other little thing in there when they, you know, like we were talking about how there's going to be a lot of concept of manufacture and trade, you know, but they still have to eat, you know, so you have the city centers surrounded by agriculture. And notice, you know, here you see that little reminder, you don't have mere herding, right? You've evolved that in parallel to farming and you have ranching. You know, you farm animals, right? In the same way that you farm plants, you know. So, you know, that cattle raising. So, you know, you actually have the concept really of a ranch, you know, as opposed to just, you know, herders.
Right.
What was that?
Hey,
you rancher, yes. I tell you, okay. Okay, so that's it. You know, and in terms of the archaeology's comments thrown in there, you know, they're giving you know sort of general rules about that that phenomenon to help the archaeologist have a little bit more of a firm appreciation of these things. You know, they're constantly digging these things and guessing. You imagine it's all kind of confusing. It's stuff is all jumbled together horizontally and vertically, and it's kind of a mess. And so the relatives are throwing in a few little points of clarification to help them sort that out a little bit better. The one of the reasons for helping with that comes up in the next paragraph. At times, it's difficult to figure out how old stuff is in some of these places. And there's we have this bias to rationalize everything. Well, it has to be sometime since 5000 BC, or, you know, at best. I mean, it's got to be sometime since 2000 BC, or something like this, you know, so they rationalize it, make it all fit, with no clue about the Andites and how some of this stuff could go way back, right? And you just, you know that can't be the case, and so it never occurs to you to look at the data with that in mind, that maybe this isn't as recent as, you know, it appears with your current set of initial assumptions as a bias. What if you looked at it with new eyes, knowing that, you know, technically, you know, this stuff could be tens of thousands of years old, and Andite.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we'll, you know, see a little example of that here coming up next.
The widespread use of metals was a feature of this era of the early industrial and trading cities. You have already found a bronze culture in Turkestan dating before 9000 BC, and the Andites early learned to work in iron, gold, and copper as well. But conditions were very different away from the more advanced centers of civilization. There were no distinct periods, such as the stone, bronze, and iron ages. All three existed at the same time in different localities.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I often kind of just speak in those sort of general classic terms about dates for the Bronze Age, Iron Age, and stuff, you know, just to kind of help contextualize things. But obviously, the geologists recognize it's not that simple. I mean, the archaeologists recognize it's not that simplistic. But it's even more complicated, as we've talked, you know, than they imagine, right? That you could theoretically find some iron, quote unquote, Iron Age thing that was way, way back, you know, with Adamson or something, right? But, you know, here you see, like I said, you have already found a bronze culture in Turkestan dating before 9000 BC. You're going, well, wouldn't I have heard about that? You know, they've in other words, one of the, you know, I'm not familiar with all the archaeological sites in Turkestan, but there's, you know, they're pointing out back there at the beginning of the 20th century, one of those that we found back then, and there was a lot of Bronze Age culture stuff found, kind of seminal stuff back then. They're saying, you know, you think that's, you know, like 2500 BC or something? Actually, okay, it's before 9000 BC. You know, when you are absolutely certain there could not in any way be anything bronze in existence.
Let alone iron.
Let alone iron or something, yeah.
And there must be a reason that we have to know that.
Well, it
pointed out.
Yeah, I mean, part of, you know, having to know that, quote unquote, as you're saying, they're trying to give us hints that will open up to a better set of initial assumptions about our history. Yeah, and give us initial clues of, you know, so you're reading this book and you're thinking, I don't know. Well, go dig over there. See what you find. And you might go, well, that's kind of curious. That seems to kind of match what they say in that weird Urantia book. Right? So they're, they not only have to try to encourage us to come into relationship with the truth that is revealed, but as I was saying earlier, the predicate for that is they have to get you synchronized with the coordinated essential knowledge of the revelation, the foundation for the revelation of truth. See, or you're going to have to just reject it because it's like, this doesn't have any factual foundation to rest on, this stuff they're talking about, omniphim and whatnot. Or you just, you know, you don't care about facts and you'll just believe anything that you find in a fancy book. Right? They're looking for something besides those who just will dismiss it because of, you know, it doesn't seem to have factual foundation to it. And only be accepted by people who just believe anything they're told.
Yeah. So, but also it must be important for our, those little points are important for, if we didn't know that, then we couldn't get to light and life or something like that. I can't find words, but
yeah, it's important. it's important so that we, I mean, think of just one simple thing. I could say many things, but one little simple fact. I quote it all the time. You know, in order to achieve wisdom, you have to face facts and adjust them to ideals. Right? There have to be facts, right? There's racial facts, right? There's historical facts that if you don't have them and then face them, there's no way to get to wisdom. Okay, it's a philosophic revelation. It's trying to not only foster a relationship to truth, you know, the truths of eternity, but the wisdom in time that's predicated on those truths of eternity. Right? We have to have a wisdom about our nature as humans so that we aren't trying to base our governmental decisions, for instance, on some false notions about mankind. Like, there aren't really races. That's all just a, you know, scheme that people have dreamt up to oppress people or whatever. No, you have to face the fact that there are races, which again, immediately go, you know, we probably can't just pool everyone together into a globe. For no other reason, there are races, and races innately are differently minded. And we're going to read about that here shortly. Yeah, and there's been blending, but it hasn't been blended into some homogeneity. I've noticed slight differences in skin color on the planet. Okay. There's all these, this, like I said, I mean, you have to reflect a little more deeply with some of the facts that are laid out in the book to figure out kind of why they're there. But when all is said and done, whether it's a shallow dive or a deep dive to understand, it's so that you have your scientific and religious thoughts based on facts. In the religion papers, they talk about that, and they italicize the word facts, right? How important that is, right? You have to have those facts as a foundation for both science and religion. Or there can't be any genuineness to either. And if not, then there can't be any super additive consequence, really, to philosophy, which means there can't be the stable context for civilization, which means civilization will collapse. Right? It's all gets to that end.
Yep. And those facts, and isn't it kind of like planting your feet, being able to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, you... planting your feet on facts is Jesus's analogy of building upon the rock, as opposed to building upon sand, figments. Now, there's all kinds of people now that are trying to build on figments, build upon the sand of their mind. Figments like we're all born equal. it's a big one. A lot of people are basing their whole mode of thought and hence all of their conclusions on that false predicate. It's not a fact. And you're just doomed to catastrophe if you think it is a fact and base all of your, governmental decisions based upon that supposed fact. Okay. All right. So, the fact that there's a very ancient bronze culture, we know why Turkestan, because that being a very near-term Andite location, like we've read about, and we'll get a little follow-up on the next paragraph in that mode. Another thing, just another little comment, is it implies in Egypt, for instance, and other places, there's often people forget how much the climate has changed. And they look at a very desert setting today, and falsely think, it's been like that, for all of human history, way beyond recorded human history, it's like, no, that's not a fact, right? It wasn't that far back. That was a wonderful open grazing land, and there was all kinds of people there and a lot of civilization. Sure, it's almost uninhabitable now, but, you know, go back to 9,000 B.C., say, and okay, very different story. And it wasn't a desert back then. You know, people forget that. There was a lot of water in northern Africa, you know, if you go back enough thousands of years, if you go back before recorded history. Okay, so that's another thing that they're sort of between the lines there in tossing out that 9,000 B.C. date. I'll wait till the next paragraph because that comes up. All right, I think we got everything there. Let's go on here.
Gold was the first metal to be sought by man. It was easy to work and, at first, was used only as an ornament. Copper was next employed, but not extensively until it was admixed with tin to make the harder bronze. The discovery of mixing copper and tin to make bronze was made by one of the Adamsonites of Turkestan, whose Highland copper mine happened to be located alongside a tin deposit.
Okay, so they just said 9,000 B.C. Okay, we've gone way beyond that. Okay, it doesn't say one of the Andites in Turkestan. No, one of the Adamsonites, okay, in Turkestan. You have to go way back to be talking about Adamsonites, not Andites. At least pre-15,000 B.C. Probably a lot further back than that. So bronze, people figured out mixing copper and tin to make bronze way before 3,500 B.C., way, way, way before 3,500 B.C., and like we've talked about so many times, you know, not to mention smelting iron and stuff.
Well, it's kind of easy to understand the bias that archaeologists have, because one, they don't know about the Andites, about the violent race uplift, the material son and daughter, but they don't, just how long do things last? Iron rusts fairly quickly.
Yep.
Bronze takes a lot longer. Stone, maybe not at all. I mean, stone is going to last.
Yeah.
Be found long after.
Yeah.
Bronze.
Not to mention, like they pointed out, some of this stuff, it might still be there, but you'd have to dig. Don't forget, this stuff has gotten buried, right? Right? And you think, well, I mean, it's all, you know, it could only be 2,500 years or something, you know, it's like, you know, and the rate the stuff builds up, you know, it could only be so deep. No, dig deeper. Like I said, a lot of places, it's there, but no one's ever found it, even though they've been digging there every day for centuries, because no one digs below a certain level because they know there's nothing below that level.
Oops.
Right? They would just stick the shovel in the ground a couple more times. Right? Very curious things would be unearthed. You know, at depths that you know there can't be any signs of civilization. Right, so yeah, that's one of the reasons why they threw in the thing about the tells. Right, I mean, don't just think in terms of mounds, but you know, think in general. Think of what's buried under the sands of the Sahara, for instance. Yeah, you know, or like we've talked about, what's underneath the Mediterranean, you know, all around the periphery of it, that for a long, long time was not covered with water, but was a highly prized place for civilization to be. You know, what might be down there a ways? You know, and again, you know how fast the mud builds up bottom of a lake, right? So that stuff is going to be, not only is it down in the water, but it's down deep in the mud too. You're not just going to go, you know, snorkeling and find something, okay? So Right, so they're just reminding, you know, everyone of these issues, that because of the Handites, there's a depth of stuff that could be unearthed all over the place in many ways, you know, including stones with the original Seven Commandments from Dalmatia carved on them, right? Somewhere in the under the mud of the Persian Gulf. Talk about going back a ways. Yeah, let's go back 500,000 years. Right. How deep is it? 500,000 years of buildup and geologic, you know, activity and stuff. The Tigris and Euphrates, you know, flowing, you know, into that area and all that. So, anyway, let's see, anything else there? Does anyone remember, you know, you have copper and tin to make bronze. What's the other thing like bronze that we make with copper?
Brass.
And what do you use with, instead of tin?
Zinc.
Yeah, zinc, you know. All right. Just notice that was, you know, that took longer to figure out. Because even when you're talking about Adamsonites and whatnot, okay, it was made by one of the Adamsonites of Turkestan whose Highland copper mine happened, right, to be located alongside a tin deposit. Right? So there's still that coincidental thing of, you know, you accidentally pouring two things together and go, oh, this is actually cool. You know, I mean, he tripped it.
Tin.
You know,
well, you've got tin on my copper.
Right, exactly. You can imagine how, you know, he found this other stuff and was playing with both of them, and he, you know, he tripped over something, you know, one day, and, you know, and dumped them together and made an incredible discovery. Instead of that bendy copper stuff, he had something solid. Okay.
Does reflection work like that? You think about something over and over and searching.
It does. I mean, reflection does work that way a bit, because, you know, when you come across something that you know is interesting, but you don't quite know how to fit it in, you stick it in the back of your mind, you know, and just keep doing that over the years. And as the years roll on, one day you'll be reflecting on something, seeing all those parts that don't fit into a picture are all laying there, and your reflective thinking synthesizes them into a picture, puts them together. It was nothing that you sort of planned. It's just a coincidence that they're all laying beside each other in your mind, just like the copper and tin were laying beside each other in the earth. Yeah, so it's a parallel. Yeah. Okay, keep going here.
With the appearance of crude manufacture and beginning industry, commerce quickly became the most potent influence in the spread of cultural civilization. The opening up of the trade channels by land and by sea greatly facilitated travel and the mixing of cultures as well as the blending of civilizations. By 5000 BC, the horse was in general use throughout civilized and semi-civilized lands. These later races not only had the domesticated horse, but also various sorts of wagons and chariots. Ages before, the wheel had been used, but now vehicles so equipped became universally employed both in commerce and war.
Okay, so, you know, we see again, you know, we know that 8,000 to 6,000 BC range for those Andites going everywhere on horseback. And you know, so in the wake of that, at 5,000 BC, we, you know, not just civilized, but even semi-civilized lands have horses now. And, you know, it's not just the war that's, you know, those very militaristic Andites that are behind this. Like they say, commerce quickly became, see, initially, okay, you might say it's war, but commerce quickly became the most potent influence in the spread of cultural civilization. So again, right, how they're pointing out how important commerce is to consequential interplay of peoples on the planet. It's not going to be everyone traveling to some location for some visionary conference, right? That's going to move things towards light and life, like they say in that visionary peace planning paragraph, right? Right? It's commerce. No matter how much that seems crass and debased to your budding spiritual consciousness, you know, you have to recognize how fundamentally important commerce is to the progress of civilization.
Not to diminish, though, that someone going to maybe a spiritual conference.
It doesn't say that there are no other influences. It's just the most potent influence is that. See,
there's not yeah. a dichotomy.
No, it's not a dichotomy. No,
it's so often that my mind wants to like just go, okay, yeah. that means everything else is in this bad bin over here, you know, and
yeah.
throw it in there. But because
yeah.
there's been wonderful.
Yeah, of course. See, yeah. but that's just the whole point. It's just to recognize that, you know, there's effective and then there's very effective, you know, and what's very effective is often not what your spiritual consciousness suspects.
Face the facts.
Yeah. Again, because, you know, that whole process of getting to, you know, up to the threshold of nations is all quite natural, right? And mankind is not naturally thinking about, you know, some visionary, you know, a land of peace or something like that, right? He's right. War is natural and all this sort of stuff. So, I mean, it has to be the case that mankind is pushed forward a long ways by just what kind of happens naturally, because of his bellicose nature or because of his selfish desires or whatnot. You know, we progress in spite of ourselves. You know, there will be great place for the mutual edification of the recognition of ideals. Set aside the visionary thing. You know, make it solid and real, right? That, you know, that mutual edification of the recognition of ideals, that will serve a very important role in the future when we get way down the path. But as they point out, we're not even remotely there yet. You know, you're getting way ahead of yourself if you think that's what's going to do it right now. We're still very much in the mode where commerce is what's going to continue to move things forward. And you have to judge it, you know, despite the fact that it's not perfect. You have to recognize it as perfecting. It has a value. Not a value in eternity, a value in relative to time. Judge it properly. Okay, but anyway, you know, we're going to from wheels and various modes to, you know, putting them on wagons, chariots, and right.
Before we leave that,
yep, yep.
You know, it's a common misconception that people with high ideals
mm-hmm.
can do no wrong. But if you apply high ideals to a wrong idea, you can do great harm.
Yeah.
I mean, much more harm than you could if you didn't have any ideals.
Exactly. Right. I mean, that's that. You know, it's only real harm befalls you when you apply an ideal at the wrong time. That's what brings real harm into play. I mean, as the book points out all over the place, and it's talking about the evolution of mankind, you know, it's not that this person had an absolutely bad visualization of ideals. No. They actually basically got it. The mistake they made is they applied it too soon. That was something that was supposed to be done 200 years hence, and they did it today, and it caused utter calamity and the collapse of the whole culture. You know, and some of these are very tricky, like things about the roles of men and women, say, in society and things. Some of these are very difficult to deal with patiently. Right? We have very strong recognitions of the way things should be, you know, in the future. But if we try to apply those ideals in a non-evolutionary way, change without growth is potential evil. You won't get the goodness that you see in the ideal in your mind. You'll get the exact opposite when you apply it too soon. You'll get evil and not goodness. No matter how much that just, how, you know, like you're saying, I mean, someone with high ideals can do no wrong. It's like, no, someone with high ideals can do real wrong. Right? If you really get a hold of your adjuster, you could really damage your soul. Until you really get a hold of your adjuster, there's no way to do any damage to your soul. Because the adjuster is the only thing that can damage the soul. Because it's the only thing that can build the soul. It's the only thing that can put hands on the soul. You can't. Only it can. Right? See, so that's the double-edged sword. And that's why there's an emergency. You know, we actually are getting a hold of high enough things that we can do real harm to ourselves and to civilization. Now, the basic issues with us as individuals was taken care of 2,000 years ago. You know, everyone gets adjusters by grace now. All right, so, you know, you're not going to get yourself so messed up, you're never going to meet the prerequisites to getting an adjuster and hence having a soul and not make it to the next life, right? You know, so there isn't an individual, see, spiritual emergency, but there's still the civilizational one. We can still do real harm to civilization. We can still impact its tenuous relationship to eternity. And when time loses its connection to eternity, it loses value, right, and collapses. Okay. Let's see. So we got, like I was saying there at the end, you know, we all know that by the time you get to, like, say, 5,000 BC, you have all of the basic concepts of ancient civilization. You've got, wars happening with chariots and what have you. And all of that, had that Andite predicate of, that initial sort of spreading themselves militaristically, like we talked about. But then, having done that, then they immediately settled in and commerce took it everywhere. Because they could conceive of commerce and not just, the only thing to life is putting something in the hole in your face, you know, frequently enough that you don't starve to death. You know, they could imagine beyond the immediate. And so they did it. They did. And it spread everywhere. All right?
The traveling trader and the roving explorer did more to advance historic civilization than all other influences combined. Military conquests, colonization, and missionary enterprises fostered by the later religions were also factors in the spread of culture. But these were all secondary to the trading relations, which were ever accelerated by the rapidly developing arts and sciences of industry.
Okay, so there they're pinning it down. Not only is it the most potent influence, but, you know, it's like, well, what do they mean by most? Well, greater than all everything else combined. That most. Yeah. There's a place for missionary enterprises fostered by later religions, you know, or what? Yeah. Yeah. It's not a dichotomy. And military conquests, obviously, you know, like we said, that's kind of a sort of the next biggie. You know, it's one of the reasons why war is indispensable. But see, nothing, when all is said and done, nothing tops even remotely commerce. You know, and so that's, again, why one of the reasons, you know, we've talked about, you know, back when we talked about commerce before in the Civilization Papers, how incredibly problematic it is that more and more so-called idealists are demonizing commerce. I mean, they just don't recognize what they're doing. They're just dooming us to the collapse of civilization. It's the really, really the most important thing that's keeping things going here in our current primitive state. A relatively primitive state. okay. You know, notice at the end there, the arts and sciences that the prince's staff was trying to foster 500,000 years ago, and that all blew up 200,000 years ago. Well, evolution, right, through the Andites and those that follow, gets around, and you actually can talk about arts and sciences of industry, right? Not just industry. Yeah, so all those things are, you know, like I said, that's the point. I mean, you take it far enough forward, and you see the evolutionary process beginning to actually make up for the rebellion and the default. Right? We eventually had sewer systems. Right? It took until 5 years ago. Okay, took 200,000 years. Right, but sure enough, that which revelation failed to accomplish, evolution eventually achieved. And
we have garbage.
And we have garbage. You know, we have garbage trucks, and you know, we have street sweepers, and you know, what have you. Okay.
Infusion of the Adamic stock into the human races not only quickened the pace of civilization, but it also greatly stimulated their proclivities toward adventure and exploration, to the end that most of Eurasia and northern Africa was presently occupied by the rapidly multiplying mixed descendants of the Andites.
Okay, just stressing that other thing, you know, the traveling trader and the roving explorer did more, you know, that roving explorer element, again, that, you know, that's tied in with the sciences there and that curiosity to explore. So they're just transitioning, see, from that sciences to re-emphasizing that, and then at the end, the multiplying mixed descendants, and that transitions us to the next section. So now we're going to look back at all these race issues and bring it forward to what we experience today. You know, we don't experience six Sangic races and Andonites and Nodites and, you know, and Adamites. You know, we don't experience that. So they want to lay that out a little bit. And, you know, here's a great example of what we were talking about earlier, you know, when you were asking me some questions there, Doug. Some facts that need to be there. And as I said, I mean, I think everyone knows that these are facts that there are so many people that are mightily trying to use their free will to close their eyes to. There's none so blind as those who will not see. It takes a lot. It's very unnatural to blind yourself to the facts of race. And so, see, you're using your human potential in a very unfortunate way. To a high degree, but flipped 180 degrees to what you should be doing, you're destroying your relationship to fact with your personality. And it's the destructivity side instead of the creativity side. So this is a biggie, you know, and of course, it immediately will remind us of the unfortunate tangents that got it to be such a problematic issue today. The notions that you know, that the Nazis picked up on and took off in greatly false ends. So we're going to have calipers on craniums again, measuring, you know, if you're broad-headed or long-headed and that sort of stuff. But you know, they're gonna try to step into all of that confusion and delusional pursuits, and and try to give us a solid summary of the basic facts there that you can fall back on, and then try to rethink your experiences anew instead of based upon the false way you were taught to think about your experiences with your fellow man of different body shapes and skin colors and hair colors and eye colors and whatnot. Okay, let's see what we got here.
Number four, the mixed races. As contact is made with the dawn of historic times, all of Eurasia, Northern Africa, and the Pacific Islands is overspread with the composite races of mankind. And these races of today have resulted from a blending and reblending of the five basic human stocks of Urantia.
Okay, so you see there that they're, you're going, well, wait a minute, there's people in places besides Eurasia, Northern Africa, and the Pacific Islands. Yeah, but okay, in Southern Africa, right, they're not pure indigo, right? But it's kind of predominantly indigo there, so it's not so much mixed race, quote unquote. And of course, in North and South America, yeah, it's not all pure red man, but right, it's in relative terms. So they wanted, they're just focusing there on the areas that got, even quite a number of thousands of years ago, quite a bit of mixing. Okay. And we all know everything is even more mixed, today. But that's, the title is The Mixed Races, that's the title of the paragraph. So that's the why they're, do you remember what the deal is with the Pacific Islanders? Like say, especially the Polynesians and Micronesians, those are mixed in what way?
The seafaring visitors.
Well, there's the Anna, went out there, but, in terms of the Sangiks, right, I mean, what two Sangiks gives you brown man, quote unquote? Right, gives you the Polynesian, red and yellow,
red and yellow.
Red and yellow, right? So that's why they're mixed race. Okay.
So they include those in the five, or are they just left red out because they're supposed to be? They said there's only five.
No, the five is what we're coming up on here in a minute. Okay. Yeah, that's a couple paragraphs down here when we're getting to the five they're talking about. And so you notice that five basic human stocks of Urantia. See, that's I was just about to bring that up. They're going to go a little bit beyond talking about races in a sort of a direct or pure sense, but more about stocks. As you start to blend, you don't so much have races, but you have something that's kind of race-like. Right, these they're going to use that word stocks, right? A stock with a certain racial nature. Okay, and so kind of going beyond talking about nine races, see, into five stocks. That's the step they're taking. Okay.
Each of the Urantia races was identified by certain distinguishing physical characteristics. The Adamites and Nodites were long-headed. The Andonites were broad-headed. The Sangic races were medium-headed, with the yellow and blue men tending to broad-headedness. The blue races, when mixed with the Andonite stock, were decidedly broad-headed. The secondary Sangics were medium to long-headed.
Okay, so in simple terms, with this long-headed, broad-headed concept, you've got three flavors. You've got long-headed, medium-headed, broad-headed. Okay, and the Adamites and Nodites are long-headed. The Andonites are broadheaded, and all the Sangiks in a very general way are in between of medium-headed. Okay, so think about that. See, it's like, oh, well, that's obviously not random, right? You've got the Aboriginal peoples are the most broad-headed, right? Those who came down from heaven, as it were, right? The Adamites, you know, and the Nodites, you know, with them, are long-headed. You see, and so, well, the Sangiks, you know, we all, you know, as we talked about it, Sangiks are definitely a step forward in quality of human relative to the Aboriginal Andonites. See, and notice it literally is there in this sequence with the head shape. You go from broad to medium to long as you get closer and closer to the pattern on high. See, so that's another way of thinking about when the life carriers designed us to have Andonites instead of merely Sangiks. They're not just making something that's different. See, you can think of it linearly. They're making it further removed in kind of a linear fashion from the Adamites. You go one step and you get Sangiks. You go two steps, which they did, and you get Andonites. And the head shape, see, is in a logical sequence there. See, of change. Okay, so that's the course picture that they're bringing out there about that. And then they point out something, you know, that's kind of curious. Your first thought is, okay, well, I don't just have Sangiks, I have primary and secondary. And so your first thought is, oh, I bet the secondaries are probably more like the Andonites, because we all look down on those secondary Sangiks, like black man, okay? And the primaries, oh, they're primary, they're going to be, no, it's, it's almost like the last shall be first and the first shall be last sort of a thing. It's actually, so they both start in medium, you know, like red is kind of right in the middle of medium, and as you go yellow, blue, right, it goes towards broad-headed. And is, you know, and you go red, green, indigo, it goes towards long-headed. Or orange, did I say red? Orange, green, indigo. It goes towards long-headed. The secondaries, just throwing that in very clearly, despite the fact that you easily can notice that, but you, if you're really in a kind of a unfortunate, I could say Nazi-esque sort of bias about this, right? Right, you ignore that long-headedness, you know, in Africa, say. It's like, see, but so that's an interesting thing just to note that, yeah, in their actuality, the secondary Sangiks might seem quite limited. But see, the head thing actually is hinting at a potentiality. And see, and you know that's the case. I mean, they're all human. So if the immediate actuality is lower, that means the potentiality is higher. All right? When you start out in a very lowly world, you have more potential than someone that starts out on a higher world. It's the same thing, see? See, isn't that curious that obvious fact, you go, whoa, and that actually is in the head shape. It reminds you how this is all one system. And even something you would think is completely incidental and irrelevant, like the head shape, the Nazis, if anything, kind of made everyone want to believe that was all just a bunch of foolishness. Like, well, not totally. Especially if you look at it more objectively, which they didn't have a tendency to do. Those Nazi scientists. It's actually a very interesting thing. So there's a physics there that is, why on earth, would there be a long-headed, broad-headed spectrum relative to Aboriginal peoples, Adamites? What I mean, why does that require the cranium dimensions to change? I mean, isn't that mysterious? What's up with that? But it's obviously designed and, you know, and purposeful. I mean, it's the pattern is so immediate, immediately recognizable. Okay, so that particular paragraph, see, is sort of the, you know, where they, you're just like full on having to confront that verboten subject of Nazi scientists and their calipers. Okay. All right, but in that mode, now they're going to talk about these five basic human stocks, that perspective on this situation.
Although these skull dimensions are serviceable in deciphering racial origins, the skeleton as a whole is far more dependable. In the early development of the Urantia races, there were originally five distinct types of skeletal structure. 1. Andonic, Urantia aborigines. 2. Primary sanguic, red, yellow, and blue. 3. Secondary sanguic, orange, green, and indigo. 4. Nodites, descendants of the Dalmatians. 5. Adamites, the violet race.
Okay, so two things there. First, in the little preface to the list, you've heard me say this a number of times before when we start talking about skull dimensions. If you study the whole skeleton, right, the whole body, you get a much more systematizable picture, right? It allows it to be less subject to the minutia variations of the part, you know, and you're looking at it more holistically. And they're saying, so definitely if you consider the whole skeletal structure, you very much can see that you have these five stocks. Okay, and so to look at that list. And so, first on the endpoints, you have one and five, right? And we already saw that when they're talking about the head dimensions, skull dimensions. You have the broad-headedness of the Andonites on one end, you know, and the innate original long-headedness of the Adamites on the other end. Okay, the other three, how would I order them? Well, you go, well, originally, Nodites were Andonites. So, they're once they, you know, are mutated into something that's basically like an Adamite, okay, they're going to be right next to Adamites, but, you know, which direction from Adamites should they be on, you know, which side? Well, they should be on the side where you're heading towards Andonites. They're like an Adamite slightly towards the Andonite end of the spectrum. And so that's why they're there. And then the primary and secondary sanguics, see, here you see, if you consider the whole skeletal structure, you see some, you know, the commonality amongst the secondary sanguics and the commonality amongst the primary sanguics. And so you can set the specific three races aside and think about them collectively as the primary sanguics on the one hand and the secondary sanguics on the other. And again, we already saw, I mean, they're medium-headed. Okay, so they're in between Adamites and Andonites. And sure enough, they are on the list. They're in between the two endpoints. But which one is going to be closer to the Andonites? Well, the primary sanguics. They're the more broad-headed in their medium-headedness. Right? And so, you know, on the one hand, you might be, as you look at this, you might be thinking, oh, well, primary sanguics are number two because they're kind of higher in the list. You know, they're above secondary sanguics. You know, but wait a minute, the Adamites are at the bottom of the list. So that's not an appropriate way to think about it. And when all is said and done, yeah, the secondary sanguics in this skeletal sense are closer to the Adamites than the primary sanguics. So if you want to, instead of judging them, you know, in certain ways, judge them by their skeleton, right? And who's least? You know, who's greater? So a simple little fact that you have to face like that could help with our tendency to so look down upon secondary sanghiks. And there's actually an appropriateness of fixating in something like seemingly material as skeleton or head or skull. It's giving you a hint that you're going off in falseness when you sort of just universally look down upon them. Their skeleton is telling you otherwise. There's a greatness there that, yeah, it might not be recognizable on the surface, but it's there. All right, so that, I mean, I hope I'm not overplaying this, but it, you see, in that they're trying to help us with issues of race. They're trying to give us some facts that challenge our silly, self-serving assumptions. Right? And they're actually using the modality of the Nazis to do it. They're turning the Nazi thing on its head. See?
Broadhead,
yeah, but they knew full well where, you know, I mean, what the Nazis took a tangent of was in full play as the revelation is being given. You know, those the scientists, you know, were all over this stuff, you know, long before it got taken off on the tangents that the Nazis did. Right? Those first two decades of the 20th century, the scientists, every scientist on the planet was all over this stuff, and we're totally in agreement, you know, with all these, you know, thinking about humans in, you know, biologic genetic ways, facing the facts of biology, genetics. And now anyone that does that is called a racist, right? All those people in the first two decades of the 20th century are all called racists, all those scientists. But they were just facing facts. Right?
It seems like these days people are taking a look at the human genome more closely again. And
yeah.
I think there's trends that direction.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that the people on the planet are starting to, you know, separate that kind of research and study and the value in that from when you're relating to individual people. And looking at people as that person.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, two points there you're making. Well, you know, that facts are facts. You know, as long as there are people who are trying to be scientists anyway, the facts are stubborn things, right? You just, the more you dig, the more the facts are, right? You know, the more you dig into genetics, the more the facts of race become undeniable, right? So it'll come back around again. Eugenics will come back around again. All those things are inescapable. And then the other thing, as you're pointing out there, you know, is we were, in many ways, in the wake of abuses of these thoughts by Nazis and others, we were making great efforts to stop judging people by their bodies, but instead judging them by their minds. Independent of your body, what's the quality of your mind? Right? And we were beginning to actually judge people properly, right? Because you're not a body, you're a mind. The you of you is not a body. You have a mindal self, not a material self, a bodily self. You have a mindal self. We were making significant progress in setting the body aside, like skin color and, you know, and other issues, lip shape or whatever, nose shape, or you know, and looking to the mind, the quality or lack thereof of the mind. But see, that's another part of the emergency. That's reversing now in the last few years. More and more people are going back to what's natural, judging the book by its cover. Right? And, you know, those very people that, you know, for a number of years were constantly telling everyone, Well, don't ever make some statement about the quality of someone based upon their skin color. And then they got everyone to nod their head up and down, and now they've turned around and said, well, actually, that's exactly how you should judge someone, is based upon their skin color. You know, only now it's supposedly okay because the skin color that's bad is white. Right? You know, and if you have white skin, you're innately evil. And that racism is fine. I mean, that's to be honored and fostered for the advancement of mankind. Right, so racism, you see, has gotten all totally flipped around. And now there's just avid racists again. Interesting, we're at the beginning of the next century. So that's, we're losing that again. Because the body is immediate, the mind is not. I see your body, I don't see your mind. I have to reflectively recognize the existence of your mind. I don't have to reflect at all to see the fact of your body. Your body just is there. And you can stick your leg out and I can trip over it. But the mind, you know, the existence of mind requires the initial effort of reflective thinking to recognize the existence of it apart from body, to abstract it from body. And there's no, you know, it's sad to record, there's almost no reflective thinking anymore. So everyone is losing sight of mind and judging people by their body again. You know, only now it's, you see, we're picking up, like we talked about, we're picking up that age-old hatred of the Andites again. You know, the fact that the Andites went out and set themselves up as rulers with their fair skin, all right, those with non-fair skin have been stewing on this fact for thousands of years. And like I said, you know, it started to bubble up and a lot of that got overthrown in Europe some and stuff, you know. I mean, it wasn't literally a skin color thing, but at least the broadheads took over the rule from the longheads or something, right? We're getting into that mode again. You know, that's right. We really should hate. And if you have white skin and a long head, okay, even more, you know, you are to be universally despised. So that, yeah, that's coming back into vogue with a vengeance. You know, that hatred of the Andites is what it really is predicated on. Goes all the way back. You know, no one has to even know, you know, have any memory of the existence of Andites for that sort of unconscious, subconscious hatred to see, to be, you know, going along through time, looking for a way to bubble back up again. So there we are, nothing will get you back into tribalism like judging people by their bodies. Right? I mean, nations are predicated on minds. Yeah. Tribes are predicated on bodies. Okay? It's just, everything is all in the same mode. All right. Keep going here.
As these five great racial groups extensively intermingled, continual mixture tended to obscure the Andonite type by Sangic hereditary dominance. The Laps and the Eskimos are blends of Andonite and Sangic blue races. Their skeletal structures, come the nearest to preserving the Aboriginal Andonic type. But the Adamites and the Nodites have become so admixed with the other races that they can be detected only as a generalized Caucasoid order.
Okay, so you think about those five basic human stocks, as they call them there, and remember how you got the Sangic races going. You just had a handful of Sangics in that first family to begin with, right? But as they point out there, the Sangic hereditary dominance, You know, when a red man mated with an Andonite, there were red men children. When an indigo man mated with an Andonite, there were indigo children. Right? And everything in between, okay? As we saw in the stories we've read through, the Andonites kind of in and of themselves only continued to exist to the extent that they were kind of not touched off in the margins of geography. Okay? You know, and even in the margins, right, blue men, you know, for instance, gets blended in there, like with the Laps and the Eskimos. Okay. But as I pointed out, that blue man in the Laps, if you're a Scandinavian, there can be some Mongoloid, as we're about to read here, Mongoloid-like features from the Laps that might be blended into you, and you might not be quite so northern white race. Right, you may actually start to have some Mongoloid-like eye features and things like that.
Right. It just occurred to me, how did this happen with the Sangic races sprang out of the Andonites?
Yeah.
Okay. Yet they had, their genetics was dominant over the Andonites.
Yeah. Yeah, see, it just reminds you.
Where did that come from?
Yeah, see, where did that come from, right? See, the fact that Sangic has, as they're saying, has a hereditary dominance over the Andonites. It's like, well, wait a minute, the Sangics came from the Andonites. You know, wouldn't they have to be at best the same and most likely lesser? You know, some sort of a downstepped expression, and yet they're above. Huh, it's almost like this doesn't just magically bubble up on its own. It's almost like it's being engaged from the top down and being drawn up. Yes, of course, right? That's the evolutionary process. That's the paper, like I said, that's parallel to this one back with biologic evolution, right? The overcontrol of evolution. Matter doesn't magically bubble up into fancier and fancier animals. Mind engages it from the top down and draws it up, right? One day, when two Andonites got together and had children, there was a super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. Super additive, right? Their offspring were above them. Just like Andon and Fonten's parents come together and there's a super additive consequence, right? Their children are above them. Right? That's the whole thing. Now, you finally get that difference just so that when it comes together, it doesn't come together additively, it comes together super additively. And you've got something greater than what it came from. You know, and that's the whole story of biologic evolution. I mean, my body is quite a bit fancier than an amoeba's or a single-celled plant. How did that happen? Right? Did it just magically bubble up like that, or was it drawn up like that? No, so it's just a super additive consequence. Let's see. We're about to read about such and so oid. The oid suffix. Similar to, right? And we saw that with Cro-Magnoid. Remember, we saw him using that oid suffix. Now, just like, we know the Caucasoid, Mongoloid, Negroid, is a place where, like, everyone has heard that suffix being used. All right, keep going here.
In general, therefore, as the human remains of the last 20,000 years are unearthed, it will be impossible clearly to distinguish the five original types. Study of such skeletal structures will disclose that mankind is now divided into approximately three classes.
Okay, so just that one little tidbit there before we go into the first class. A little archaeological hint. As the human remains of the last 20,000 years are unearthed. So you have to go back farther than that to really find, even these five stocks. let alone the 9 races. Okay. So for the last 20,000 years, it's gotten to the point where it's blended into 3 more than 5. All right. So
number 1, the Caucasoid. The andite blend of the nautite and adamic stocks, further modified by primary and some secondary sangic admixture, and by considerable endonic crossing. The Occidental white races, together with some Indian and Turanian peoples, are included in this group. The unifying factor in this division is the greater or lesser proportion of andite inheritance.
As we've, of course, talked about many, many times, you know, it's basically, and like they just said up there, that generalized Caucasoid order. You know, we know that the Adamites and the Nautites, you know, go to the Andites and then basically into what we call Caucasoid. That's that dominance that differentiates Caucasoid from other. And you know, we talked in detail about, you know, what primaries and some, what, you know, somewhat secondaries were blended in, and all the Andonites and whatnot. Remember, we've run across Turanian. Remember, think about it, it's just like Iran and Turan, Iranian and Turanian. They're a pair of words to describe the peoples in those adjacent geographic areas. You've got, you know where Iran is, you know, to definitively be talking about juxtaposed to it geographically, Turan, go north of the Oxus River. You know, so, you know, go north of the northern border of Iran today, you know, a little bit until you hit the Oxus River. And definitely when you get on the north side of the Oxus River, you know, in terms of ancient thinking, you have the contrast between the Turanians to the north and the Iranians to the south. Okay. You know, and of course that makes sense. We know how much andite, you know, we were just talking about it in Turkestan, right? I mean, there's, you know, you're going to have, you know, some Caucasoid there, you know, in Turkestan, and you're obviously going to have it in northern India, right? From all the andites that went into northern India. Okay, so that's and it's Caucasoid because you know, remember about the migrations of these people, and people try to extrapolate back. And I think these white people came from somewhere, you know, around the Caucasus, right? You know, between the Black and Caspian Seas. You know, they didn't know you had to go, you know, a little bit further into Central Asia to really find the source, you know, more directly. But that's why they're called Caucasoids. You know, they're similar to the ones that they believed came from the Caucasus region. Yeah, that's where the term comes from. Yeah, and again, like I said, we kind of saw that as they, you know, were wrapping their way around the two, you know, around the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea and heading into Europe. I mean, right, if you only trace that part ways back, you might think they came from that region. Okay, next.
Number 2, the Mongoloid. The primary Sangic type, including the original red, yellow, and blue races. The Chinese and Amerinds belong to this group. In Europe, the Mongoloid type has been modified by secondary Sangic and Andonic mixture. Still more by Andite infusion. The Malayan and other Indonesian peoples are included in this classification, though they contain a high percentage of secondary Sangic blood.
Okay, so if you don't get too deep into, especially all the Indigo Man that went, you know, into Southeast Asia there, you've got something that, you know, you can still sort of still tipped on the side of primary Sangic rather than secondary Sangic. And, you know, and so Mongoloid, you know, is similar to Mongolians, right? Just a, you know, meaning there. You know, and we saw, you know, and they mentioned the Lapps, you know, and they said, I mean, modified by secondary sangic and andonic mixture, right? There's an example of, you know, taking the blue man, right? Which, if you saw a blue man, you go, oh, he's a Mongoloid. You know, the closest you can get to that is you know, it's like with laps, you blend in a bunch of andonite and, okay. And it's kind of there sort of recessively, like I said, you know, occasionally it'll, if you've got some Laplander in your genetics, you know, occasionally you'll get a child that's like, whoa, they look Polynesian, right? In other words, see, they look a little bit Mongoloid, look a little bit primary Sangic from that blue man stock coming out. All right, so that's Mongoloid. I think everyone kind of understands Mongoloid, okay?
Number three, the Negroid, the secondary Sangic type, which originally included the orange, green, and indigo races. This is the type best illustrated by the Negro, and it will be found through Africa, India, and Indonesia, wherever the secondary Sangic races located.
So like I said, until you go too deep into, you know, Southeast Asia, when it becomes secondary Sangic dominant, like they're pointing out there, and you definitely can get some, you know, people that very indigo, you know, dark skin, you know, from Southeast Asia and those areas. After all, you have Melanesia there, right? You know, it's called that for a reason. And of course, obviously, Negroid, like they said, is similar to Negroes. You know, and so again, like we've said many times, I mean, if you saw an orange man or you saw a green man, you go, whoa, they're Negroid. Right. There's a commonality of form, you know, amongst all three secondary Sangics, that Negroid form. And not to mention the darkness. Right? I mean, secondary Sangics are darker than primary Sangics. You know, and the, you know, the Latin word Negro, you know, for black is reminding you of that. and you know, remember, you've got, you know, we've talked about this, you know, initially, I mean, basically what you've got is black melanin. You know, we talked about, you know, it's all black hair, black eyes, right? I mean, you get Adam and Eve, and you bring in, you know, the other two melanins, so that you've got brown melanin and red melanin, right? So that you can have red hair, you know, for instance, and you can get, you know, something besides black eyes. You know, I mean, you need brown melanin to have brown hair. All right, so that's the deal with that. You know, setting aside the issues of the colors of the Sangics, I mean, Adam and Eve are, in terms of pigmentation, are bringing in those non-black pigments into play. So if you go and study hair color, eye color, you know, you'll see that you run across, you know, discussions about that, how that all works. You know, and of course, as we get into mixed races, all right, I mean, we have all sorts of, you know, combinations of those three, you know, every way you can imagine, right, now on the planet. And that's why there's such a vast diversity of especially hair colors, not to mention eye colors and skin colors and whatnot. Okay.
Well, eventually ends up being gray anyway.
Right. And yeah, the black melanin turns gray. Just because you have red hair doesn't mean you have only red melanin. See, right? You know, the black melanin turns gray. Right? It's not the dominant one. I mean, see, again, you know, all of this is all predicated on the evolutionary nature. You're kind of seeing how, you know, Adam and Eve are attuned to, you know, when they're brought from Gerasim to here, they're attuned to what's here. You know, the way pigment works here, you know, so that their pigmentation, you know, modes, you know, blend into what was already here, for instance. Okay. All right. So that, yeah, we all know that. And of course, you know, like I was saying, when people reject race now, you know, what they are rejecting is Caucasoid, Mongoloid, Negroid. You know, everyone knows that. You know, that's what people think they're rejecting. They think those are the three races. Technically, those aren't races. Right? They're not even, you know, quite those five basic stocks things, you know. I mean, all right, so, you know, it's all very mixed. But it isn't all the same. There, you know, no matter how much we're denying it, you know, and then, you know, in the very recent times, we all talked about Caucasoid, Mongoloid, Negroid. You know, that's hinting at there must have been something very definitive and elemental somewhere back in the past. You kind of have these molecules now. Well, if there's molecules, there has to be atoms, right? There has to be the fundamental elements of Caucasoid, Mongoloid, Negroid, you know, for those kind of molecular structures to exist, there has to be the fundamental atoms. And yeah, there's 10. I mean, there's 9, right? You know, for the fundamental atoms back there, there's 9 races, fundamental elements of racial nature.
ATOMS, not ADAMS.
Yeah, not ADAM, ATOM, yes, yeah. Atoms of, you know, elements. All right, one last little bit here.
In northern China, there is a certain blending of Caucasoid and Mongoloid types. In the Levant, the Caucasoid and Negroid have intermingled. In India, as in South America, all three types are represented. And the skeletal characteristics of the three surviving types still persist and help to identify the later ancestry of present-day human races.
So that last little comment, again, is pointing out what I was just speaking about. These are definitive elemental facts. You can have lots of combinations of elements into all sorts of fancy molecules, but it doesn't totally erase the fact that there are underlying elements and the basic facts tied to those fundamental elements. You by no means have blended to the point where you still can't, in a very scientific way, look at skeletal structure, what they're saying there at the end, and understand your ancestry. Right? It's, you know, and I've pointed that out. The simple thing is, you know, if you look at the whole body of someone, if they're kind of rounded in features, that right there is telling you that they're more evolutionary sort of a stock. If they're, you have more angular, that means there's more andite, right? And so that's, you know, that the difference between Caucasoid and on the one hand and Mongoloid and Negroid on the other hand. So that skeletal thing is just very apparent. Like I said, especially if you consider the whole body. It has nothing to do with being overweight or fat or anything. It's just an evolutionary stock is just a more rounded stock. The angular stuff comes from Adam and Eve. And then they're obviously hinting at a lot more sophisticated things than that crude little assessment that sort of anyone, even a kid, can notice. And they're pointing out that if you stop being afraid of this scientifically, you know, went at it again, like you were starting to do at the beginning of the 20th century, you would, you could see a lot of very, direct, discernible information about the races, you know, in this way. Now, obviously, we're also approaching the subject genetically now too, and we all know that, you know. You know, send in your DNA and get an analysis, right? Where your heritage is and what part of the planet. But they're reminding you there's also the skeletal issues, because the genetics is going to be very confusing in some ways, you know. So these more immediately tangible aspects of the human body can be combined with the genetics to help you sort it out.
And they don't go back as far at all, or they don't go back.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, because like I said, the genetics, you know, is a very complicated thing, and you know, it's subject to all sorts of current assumptions that, you know.
Yeah, they don't know
anything. Right, are going to have lots of issues. Right. So.
You find out if you came over on the Mayflower.
But the other thing is, you know, it's reminding you of some obvious things. Like you go to, you know, everyone knows that you can, a lot of times you can look at the basic head shape of an African. It's like, you know, I'll bet they're Somalian, or I bet they're Ugandan, right? You know, see, because it all has to do with this broad-headed, long-headed, you know, thing, and the more long-headed peoples, you know, went here, and some of the broader secondary sanguics, you know, were there. You know, how much orange man, you know, is going to be more broad-headed than an indigo man is in there. Those, all those issues see are in play.
I play golf with a guy who's Basque.
Uh-huh.
Really tell the difference.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. I mean, that, you know, the fact that blue man is the shortest of the, you know, of the three primary sanguics, you know. Basque are not known for being, you know, 7 foot tall. Okay, it's because blue man is the shortest stock. You know, just like indigo man is the shortest secondary sanguic, and so there can be pygmies and things like that. You know, all right. So those basic issues of stature and basic body form, and you notice that they point out that you know. You go all the way to today with all of the European stuff that's gotten blended into South America, and you end up with something that's kind of India-like, because remember the secondary sanguics that came over with a red man all went south, and so you've got secondary sanguic, you've got primary sanguic, you throw in, you know, some European stuff, and you actually have something that's, you know, not totally different from how it happened in India, with the secondaries and the primaries, and then lots of andite thrown on top of it, you know, there in India. Let's see, I think everything else is pretty straightforward. But I just, you know, to wrap it up, like I said up front on this section, yeah, and Katie pointed out, I mean, scientists are going to, you know, they kind of force themselves into having to start to consider race and stuff. The more they investigate, the more these facts just can't be, you can't pretend they don't exist anymore, right? You're not going to be able to hold on to the theory that skin color is caused by what latitude you're standing at, right? That theory is just not going to hold up. Under ongoing scientific investigation, more and more, they will understand, you know, the details of the genetics, the difference between primary sanguic and secondary sanguic, or like they're saying, at least between Negroid, Mongoloid, and Caucasoid. And we're going to have to come back and face these facts. And the revelators are trying to give us, at the level at which we went off the rails with this, take us back there and help us to go forward with what we had and not go off the rails. And like I said, so that you can take those aspects of the human body and combine it with the genetics, and discover that there is a connection between the skin and what's down there in the nucleus of the cell. Yeah, you tried to bury your head in the sand by burying your head down in the nucleus of the cell. I'm not going to think about skin color. I'm just going to look at the at the chromosomes. But it's all one system, right? And we're going to have to recognize this again. And like I said, we need to be able to handle this well, because we're already showing severe signs of not handling this well and judging people by their skin color again. You know, and making blanket statements based upon skin color. And it's not a trivial situation. The more you know, the more complicated this is. Like we've pointed out, mind is attuned to the genetics. The genetics of an indigo man is different than the genetics of a red man. The mind of a red man is different than the mind of an indigo man. So you can start to judge people by their mind, but you can't totally escape the fact that that's tied to their body, at least in their initial temperament. But you can challenge, see, knowing that we all start with that genetic baggage, if you will, or boat anchor, it should encourage us all the more to challenge ourselves courageously and independently, right? To not be just the mind that's predicated on our genetics, to be something besides a natural mind, to be more and more an unnatural mind, more and more of a human mind instead of a fancy animal mind. And it's in that recognition that you have nothing but the quality of that mind, because when all is said and done, then every mind is absolutely unique. If it really is a reflection of their absolutely unique personality. And so, boy, if you start demonizing it because it's different, where is that going to go? Everyone is by definition absolutely different, right? You're going to have to come together based upon a super summative recognition, right, that goes beyond the inescapable individuality. Yep.
So you think that has to do with why the resurrection halls are divided into different races, and you know, maybe not for this planet because it's so mixed, I think they say, but
yeah. We talked about that with the resurrection halls. Yeah, because literally what you're resurrecting there is the mind, see?
Right, but is it it's not really the same human mind. Right?
Well, no, yeah, no, but okay. but it's still, I mean, the very fact that there's a resurrection hall for a red man and a resurrection hall for indigo man, and the two can't be resurrected in the same hall, right? Just reminds you of how inescapably different they are mindily. I mean, they're so different mindily that their souls are different, right? And the Marantxa mind environment that's engaging those Marantxa brains as they're being resurrected, I mean, it literally has to be in a different room to keep the energies separate.
And then what do they say about us? We're in a sort of a...
Then there's all the mixed stuff, you know, and that's and the ring around it, you know, and all that's very confusing. Like, well, how do you define mixed, and, you know, how pure does that? Does that be literally totally pure to be in one of the wings? Yeah, I mean, there's unanswered questions to that, but...
It all comes back to the same.
But, see, I mean, the details of the physics are not the more important thing. The very fact that there is difference, see, again, it's you have to face that fact. I mean, red man and indigo man are so different, you can't even resurrect them in the same hall. It's not like you leave that behind when you die. See, and if you don't leave it behind when you die, you don't leave it behind when you're a fine outer on the Isle of Paradise either, right? I mean, just the same way that, whether you started male or female, that experiential difference is still there on the Isle of Paradise, and you're way transcendent of being a male or female anymore as a fine outer. Right? But the predicate is still there. I mean, red man will always be a mind that began as a red man mind. His experiences have that inescapable nature as it's in its beginning. And as a mixed race, like we're talking about here, you will never be able, you'll never have access to the things that a mind has access to when it's a pure race. You're just, stuck with having to make up in indirect ways for what you didn't get directly because of your lack of purity. you're going to have to penetrate through the fog of not being pure and kind of get the essence of not only, you know, one purity you might imagine, but all the different purities.
Yeah, from an experimental planet.
Yeah, and all that, see. But anyway, it's very important to face these facts again, and then like I said a minute ago, you know, fully facing the facts of inescapable difference, challenge ourselves to not just be, your favorite flavor in the plane, but foster everyone to go above the plane. You know, like with religions, it's like you're not convince everyone, you know, that everyone has to be this flavor that uses a cross for a symbol or whatever. You know, the whole point is to transcend all of those evolutionary religions in the plane, transcend all the evolutionary biologic stocks in the plane, right? And be humans above all of that. You know, and until you face the facts that those differences are just there, you're not going to challenge yourself to go above them. You can have delusions like, no, they aren't really there, so we can stay in the plane, and our beginning is our ending. It's like, no, you know, the beginning is way inadequate. It's way too inescapably biased by body. There's the whole first mansion world is trying to transcend the inescapable biases of your initial body on your nativity sphere. And then the second mansion world is trying to transcend all of the inescapable mind things that are indirectly, you know, tied to the body that was inescapable on your nativity sphere. And finally, when you get to the third mansion world, you're kind of in the beginning of getting away from that animal origin bias of body and mind. And that's a long ways down the road, obviously. Okay, anyway, we'll keep chugging along. I think everyone knows that the final section of this paper is long. so we have a lot to go yet in this paper. I'm sure it'll take us at least another couple sessions. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.